Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. We got a great show for you movie fans out there tonight, this Wednesday night. My name is Jamie. Our co-host Jerry is trying desperately to connect to the switchboard. His calls are not going through. So in the first few seconds of the show tonight, we're already plagued with technical difficulties. But our first guest is on the line, so we're very thankful for that. Let me tell you a little bit about tonight's show. A great lineup of guests. A little later on in the program, we're going to be welcoming film composer Paul Cantillon. His new work is for the Oliver Stone film W, and we're actually going to premiere 6 minutes of his score for the film W as well. And towards the a little bit later in the show after that, we're going to be interviewing Thomas Alfredson, the director of a new film called Let the Right One In. And I've seen this film. It is stunning. It is really impressing festival audiences all across the country. It's the most unique kind of horror film that you've ever seen. it is a beautiful film, and I think that our co-host Jerry is actually on the line. Jerry, are you with us? Are you there?
Yes, man? I am. Sorry it took me so long to get through.
Yeah, I had some problems too. I was sweating for a little bit there.
Do you know what I have in my hand?
I can only imagine.
I have the copy of the book, All I Need to Know About Filmmaking. I learned from The Toxic Avenger, written by our guest tonight, Lloyd Kaufman.
Awesome, awesome.
I read
that
this
good.
10 years ago.
That
the same
is
week
good,
I
man.
Read Roger Corman's book, too. So.
Wow. Well, this is the perfect segue. Man, you're great at segues. You want to get to our first guest?
I do, definitely.
Okay. Our first guest tonight is a true Renaissance man. He is the writer and director of the rousing horror comedy Slither, the writer of Scooby-Doo, Scooby-Doo 2, and the terrific remake of Dawn of the Dead, and that's some versatility right there for you.
That is.
He's an actor, an author, and a musician, and his latest projects continue to take his formidable talents into new and exciting directions. He has a new reality series titled Scream Queens, which premieres on VH1 October 20th. He's written and directed a twisted sitcom for Xbox Live titled Umanzi, and you can catch the premiere episode of his new web series, I love this, PG Porn, starting today on Spike.com. And Jerry, if you can type that that link into the chat room during this conversation.
With my pleasure, my friend.
anything having to do with porn, it's really our pleasure. He's won the Filmmaker Showcase Award from the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films, a Fangoria Chainsaw Award, and he's the first person in the history of cinema to write two back-to-back number one films. It is a great pleasure to welcome Mr. James Gunn to Movie Geeks United. Mr. Gunn, hello.
What's up, guys? How are you doing?
What's up,
good,
man?
How are you?
Oh, I'm really good. I'm very happy because I just found out we've gone over 60,000 hits on PG Porn on Spike.com. So it's
helped.
Did you?
I did. If you knew what I did today at work and at home, you'd be very proud.
Did you pass out some? You pass out some emails to people?
Oh no, just me myself. Don't worry about it.
Just you. I think only any one person. Well, any one computer only gets counted once, I believe. So
okay, well don't worry. I was at three different computers today. So
that's what I want you. I want you to go to the library and start at the end of the line of those computers and just watch PG porn on one library computer after the next.
I will do that as soon as we're done with the show.
I believe you will.
Okay, now James, I was reading about you. And tell me a little bit about yourself first. I know that your family, you have an extremely creative family.
Yes.
And I was wondering if filmmaking was the avenue of choice for you right away.
No, I it wasn't for me. I you know, when I was a, I went back and forth. I was always a creative kid, I suppose.
Yeah.
Doing artistic stuff of some type was always the center of my life. And I started making movies when I was very young, 11 or 12 years old. I started making films, you know, that starred my brothers and the kids in the neighborhood, that were, you know, sometimes horror films with zombies eating each other. I was really into that. I was really into comedy. I did a movie about commercials once. It was all a bunch of commercial parodies. It was probably the worst thing ever. And it's just a bunch of kids cracking up while they're shooting. But yeah, I always made movies. But I also played music through high school and college and was a cartoonist. You know, I had cartoons and all sorts of things. So I was really, you know, I didn't know exactly what I was going to do. And I did really play music professionally for a few years when I was in my late teens and early 20s. And
yeah.
That's what I was sort of focused on. And that just kind of fell apart after a couple of years. It was staying at the same place. It wasn't getting any better. And that's when I came back to filmmaking in a very real way, through writing. And,
were horror films of a particularly influential to you?
What horror films are? I'd say that, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing. All of the movies of David Cronenberg are almost all of them, but especially The Brood and Videodrome and Rabbit and They Came From Within.
You got good taste.
Rosemary's Baby is probably my favorite horror
that
film.
That is your favorite, yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. But you got your, in terms of filmmaking, you pretty much got your start with Troma, isn't that correct?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I was wondering, how good was that for kind of on-the-job training? What was that experience?
It was perfect. I mean, you know, a lot of people complain about Troma because you don't get paid very much to work there. I wrote the screenplay for Tromeo and Juliet for $150. And that's all I ever got paid to write that film. I did, you know, go on to produce a movie, and then I got paid a weekly fee for that. But for the most, but even that was very low, you know. And Lloyd complained about what he thought was an exorbitant fee that he was paying me all the time. Which I think was,
that seems like him.
It was $400
but
a week. I know what it was.
Isn't it really the privilege and the experience to work with Lloyd worth it? The whole, I mean,
yes,
he knows
I mean,
so
it
much.
It absolutely was. I mean, because I got to learn, you know, other kids go to film school and they learn about certain parts of filmmaking, but I was able to start working for Troma and I got to learn about everything about making a movie from, you know, the first stage of developing a script through, you know, pre-production. I got to, you know, help cast the movie and I had to go, you know, I was just sort of the troubleshooter. Like, we couldn't find locations and I had to go out location scouting and location managing. And then I went on to, you know, direct a lot of the stuff in the movie and got that experience. And then after the movie was done, I got to sit through all the editing and learn about all the post-production stuff and even through the marketing and the putting the movie into theaters, the business side of it. I really got to learn everything about making a movie from A through Z, and that's such a rare experience, you know. It's such
yeah,
a rare
it's
experience.
Priceless.
I'm very
yeah.
grateful for that.
Oh, of
yeah.
course.
And now you excel at kind of comedic horror, and Slither is just a fantastically fun experience. I want you to tell me about mixing those two. I've often been curious about this, because when you try to scare someone and you try to make someone laugh, those are two kind of emotions that produce some sort of the similar release.
I really noticed early on that there's a lot more in a good horror film or decent. Let's take John Carpenter's The Thing. There's a lot of funny shit in that movie, and a lot of times, oh sorry, I'm not sure what this language.
No, you can curse as much as you want.
You're on the right show for that. Don't you worry about that.
But there's a lot of stuff in that movie that you laugh because it's actually funny. The characters say funny stuff, but there's also stuff in the movie where you laugh because it's just so outlandish and over the top. Or you laugh because, you know, you get really scared, and then you laugh after you're scared. And I think that during a screening of John Carpenter's The Thing, there's actually a lot more laughter in that movie than in most comedies. And that's the thing. Horror and comedy sort of go hand in hand, but for me, they definitely go hand in hand because, and it's not anything I set out to do. The truth is I set out to make a horror movie with Slither, and while I'm writing it, I'm making myself laugh. I wrote a novel called The Toy Collector.
Mm-hmm,
I never
yeah.
thought of it. While I was writing it, I never thought of it as a comic novel. I didn't think of it as a comedy. I thought of it as just a story. I didn't think of it as any one genre. I did, while I was writing it, you know, make myself laugh a lot because I guess that's the way I entertain myself. But I never thought of it as a comedy, and the book comes out and everybody's it's like a dark comic novel. And I'm like, okay. Same thing with Slither. When I wrote the screenplay for Slither, I wasn't sitting there trying to, you know, make a movie that was, you know, I wasn't trying to make a movie that was funny, but I guess I was because I was trying to make myself laugh all the time. But I didn't think of it like that. I just
right.
thought I was trying to make a movie that was entertaining.
Yeah, and it really
well, you did
is.
That, without
yeah.
a doubt.
You mentioned novel writing as well. What kind of different muscles do you exercise from writing a novel compared to writing a screenplay? What are the two different disciplines there for you?
They're very similar in a lot of ways. It's actually much easier writing a screenplay because it's a much shorter format. You're writing a 120-page
yeah.
script, which is a lot fewer words than is, you know, even a... you know, a 200 short novel that would be 250 pages long. So writing a novel, it's a very dense experience where you really have to go all the way into it. One of the difficulties in writing a screenplay is that you have to cut so much. I mean, you really need to keep things concise. And in fact, you know, talking to people who have created TV shows like Joss Whedon, one of the reasons why they love creating a TV show is because you don't have to just, like, hit these bullet points of a character in a scene. You really get to go in-depth into who these characters are on a TV show. A movie isn't like that. You really have to have the scenes be short. One thing leads to the next. Everything moves very quickly. Even in a movie you think of as a, you know, sort of a taut drama moves fairly quickly in comparison to a novel or a TV show.
Yeah, I think you're right. More and more just fantastic talents are moving to TV because it gives them the room to explore more than
they
can. Yeah,
I think, you know, also there's less of a stigma. You know, I mean, years ago, and, you know, not that many years ago, I moved to L.A. 10 years ago, and even then, I think there was a big divide between a filmmaker and someone who creates TV shows. But I think today, you know, I mean, in some ways, both movies and film are dying art forms. And it's just people things are more equal, and there's a lot of people that switch back and forth between the two, and that's why I find the new media stuff so interesting because it is so alive and it's so vibrant, and it's completely new, and you know the genres aren't really developed yet, so you know we get to create our own form, we get to create what you know what type of shows we want to create with no boundaries whatsoever, and it's a living medium. It's not something that's been, you know, the tracks haven't been set down for us a long time ago. So
I'm glad you.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'm glad you brought this up because we discussed this with Paul Schrader earlier this year, and he said, you know, the landscape of film as we know it is going to change into these new media, as you've mentioned. What do you think is going to happen to the motion picture experience? I mean, do you think it's going to be mostly relegated to external media like the web and that sort of thing in the future?
I don't, but I do think that already you're starting to find that the movies that work, the theatrical releases that work, are pretty much either big-budget tentpole spectacle films, things like Iron Man, that really work well as a communal experience on the big screen and that are also spectacularly visually over-the-top.
Mm-hmm.
Those things work very, very well in a movie theater, and even as movies in high definition on your, you know, on your home TV if you have a big screen TV. Those things work very well. The other thing that often works very well are comedies because you go and you experience this communal experience of people together. But I do think that independent film is dying, and one of the reasons it's dying is just simply because you know the corporations have gobbled up everything and shut out you know smaller productions. But the other reason is I just don't think people are that interested in it anymore. I think people who want to watch something that's a little bit quieter and a little bit slower will watch Dexter. You know, I mean, there's amazing TV shows that are more, they're more quirky. They're less, You know, I mean, The Sopranos was, you know, if it ever got a rating, it would have been rated NC-17 because it just went so far. You didn't have the MPAA breathing down their backs. So there's a lot more freedom in that respect. And I think on the web also, I mean, I think people get to see something. If it's idea-based, they can watch it on the Internet even now. So I do think that the way people experience entertainment is much different. And it's also, you know, listen, here's one of the things is that people are always talking about interactive media. And I think that it's not panning out. People don't want interactive media except for video games. They want to watch video games.
Mm-hmm.
And if they want to have an interactive medium, they want a medium where they have complete control, where they are the character, they're able to shoot the dinosaurs, walk through the swamps, do all of that stuff. They don't want choose your own adventure. It's too limited. But where they do want interaction is on the Internet with short-form entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of what you get with a short-form comedy today is not so much the heir to the TV show. It's the heir to the cartoon strip in the daily newspaper. Years ago, when I was growing up, you know, you'd get excited about the new, reading Blooms County or Doonesbury every day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the newspaper's died. I mean, it doesn't even exist, especially to teenagers. So I think that instead of reading the newspaper and reading those comic strips every day, you go onto the Internet and you watch 3 or 4 short-form comedy videos.
Yeah.
In between porn.
Well, of course, Mr. Gunn. I just want to ask you a question, Mr. Gunn. Do you honestly think the experience of going to see a new independent art house film, is that really on the way out, like going to my local Landmark Theater?
Yeah. There will always be a place for that, but it's really gotten killed. The other thing that's killed it is this, which is my least favorite thing about Hollywood movies is this. When E.T. came out so many years ago, E.T. made a decent amount opening weekend. It made a little bit more the next weekend, a little bit more the next weekend, and then it just kept making money and money and money because things traveled by word of mouth. Today, the culture is that of even a huge, huge, huge hit will make a third of its gross on opening weekend. So people aren't going to see movies that they hear good things about. They're going to see movies where they like the trailer or everybody, all their friends are going to see it. So people aren't going to see movies. That's the quality of films overall. I hate to sound like a curmudgeon, but the quality of mainstream cinema is worse than it's ever been because of that. Because when Warner Brothers is making a movie, they aren't thinking about making a quality movie that's going to hook an audience and get them to go tell their friends about it and go see it again and again and again. They're making movies that will get you in opening weekend and that will create an experience where, you know, the reason you're going to see it is in part because of peer pressure. And that just doesn't create good movies.
I think the prime example of that actually is just 11 years ago when Titanic opened. And Titanic opened, most expensive movie ever made. It opened with something like $18 or $21 million. But if it opened like that today, people, the press and everyone else would call it off as a failure.
Yeah.
How would that in the long term affect its ultimate gross?
The fact that your middle American, my parents in St. Louis, are always interested to see how much money movies made on Monday morning, that is a part of the conversation of going to films today. It's kind of disgusting.
It is. That started in the late 80s when the papers started publishing that on Monday or Tuesday mornings.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's really sick, if you ask me.
And read about it online. I mean, people will be judging a movie's goodness based upon its dollar amount constantly. And
they do it on Friday night now.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, if you go to Nikki Fink, you know, Nikki Fink, like, Friday night has, like, the matinee figures from Los Angeles, and it's disgusting because you were talking about Friday afternoon, the pitcher's fate has been sealed.
Yeah.
And it's disgusting.
It's a sad thing, but, you know, that's what the movie-going experience is today, so whether it's good or bad, that's the way it is. But I think that's one of the reasons why the movie-going experience is really threatened. And I don't see, I mean, honestly, I don't know what type of experience like that you think of that comes back from that and then gets better again. I just don't see it happening, you know?
We got to
go ahead.
I'm sorry, buddy. We got a caller. on the line with a question. Caller, go right ahead. Caller, go right ahead. You're on live. Okay. We're not getting you through. I think that was they're in the chat room and they said they were calling in. Joel, we didn't get your call, buddy. I'm sorry. Ask the question in the chat room and we'll relay it to Mr. Gunn. I want to talk about all these new projects you have. I got a quick question about Dawn of the Dead. I'm wondering, did that project come to you? Did you campaign for it? And did
no,
you talk to Romero at all during that process?
No, it 100% came to me. And I was my good friend Eric Newman. He's a producer. He produced Dawn of the Dead and Slither as well, as Children of Men and a lot of other like really cool movies.
Mm-hmm.
And we had been friends for years. In fact, my first ever meeting in Los Angeles, I did the Troma movies, and I moved out here and I got a really powerful manager, Peter Safran, who was at Brillstein Gray at the time. And the first meeting he ever set me up with anybody was Eric Newman. We had very similar senses of humor. We got along. We became friends, and we always wanted to work together, but we never had the opportunity. And one day he called me at home and he said, hey, and he would do this all the time, by the way. It was actually a little bit. He would call me at home with an idea or a property that he had and say, would you like to write this? And I would always say no, because I really do say no to 99.5% of everything that comes to me. And he said, you know, I think I can get the rights to Dawn of the Dead. Would you like to remake that? And I was never interested in remaking a movie, but for some reason, in that one moment, I could really see how the movie would be a lot of fun to write.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw how I could take the central concept of the original film and tell a different story with it. And one of the reasons why I never wanted to do a remake was because I thought they were irrelevant, because you could just watch the original story. But if we were able to take the central, you know, the central story or the central setup of Dawn of the Dead and tell a different story around that, that could be something really exciting to do. And I also thought, you know, frankly, as my business side came out as well, I'm like, I think it's time for a larger budget zombie movie to come out. There hadn't really ever been a larger budget zombie movie ever. And so, and by larger budget, I mean, you know, something over $20 million.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so it just came to me immediately, and I was extremely excited about it. I don't think I've ever had more fun writing a screenplay before. And,
oh, and you feel it on the screen. Yeah,
it's
you
one
really
of the few
it,
good remakes out there, so.
Yeah.
Well, thanks. I had a great time.
No, I mean that. I think the opening with Johnny Cash, the man comes around, it's just from there you're hooked, and it never lets up, and it's very well done.
Thank you.
Let's talk about PG porn.
Sure.
that seems to be what we all want to talk about, yes.
That's right. It's billed as a web series for people who like everything about porn except the sex.
That's right.
I take it you're one of those people?
Yes. I'm always watching a good porn film, and I'm enjoying the cinematography and the acting and the storyline, the set design, and then
the pizza delivery.
Something comes in to ruin it with with a gross sex scene. And then the pizza delivery boy comes, and I think this PG porn is finally time for the pizza delivery boy to come and for us to get what we wanted all along, which is warm, delicious pizza, not a threesome, not a cock in every hole. So it's PG porn actually it plays out like the little bits in between the sex scenes in old 80s horror movies. When I was young, I would go with my friends to the X-rated theater, and we'd make fun of the acting and all that stuff in an X-rated film. And this is that. This is that same thing. And every episode, we take a mainstream actor like Nathan Fillion from Slither and Firefly and Serenity, Michael Rosenbaum, who played Lex Luthor on Smallville, or my brother Sean, who was Kirk on the Gilmore Girls, and we team them up with an actual adult actress like Belladonna or Sasha Gray or Jenna Hayes or Aria Giovanni, and we put these little scenes together that take on some elements of porn in one way or another.
Oh, yeah, and I really enjoyed it. I'm really enjoying it. It's on Spike.com. I understand that you conducted kind of a poll to find out the most popular kind of porn actresses?
I just on my MySpace page, which is at myspace.com/slithermovie, one word. I post stuff in my status updates, asking questions all the time, and I asked people who the most popular porn stars were, and they, you know, started throwing out all the same names again and again, and they were like, you know, Tara Patrick, Belladonna, Jenna Hayes, Sasha Gray. They were just the same names over and over again. And so those were the people who I, you know, contacted. And the way I contacted them was writing them on MySpace. And because I didn't know anything about, we, first of all, we were doing these things very inexpensively. I put the bill for them. And I didn't have access to the managers of porn stars. Plus, I thought that if I got involved with those people, they'd screw up the deal because we weren't really paying them anything. So I contacted the porn stars directly, and almost all of them wrote me back immediately, you know, and there's a few that flaked out. But Belladonna, for instance, I wrote her. She was the first person I wrote because Belladonna must have very similar blog numbers to me, because every day after I post a blog, I check on the MySpace top blogs where I lie, and I'm usually, you know, up there, but I'm always right next to Belladonna. You know, she would be before me, or I would be right before her, and she was always, you know, she was my arch blog rival. I kind of hated her, actually, because I always wanted to beat her, and I was very happy when I was ahead of Belladonna and very pissed off when I was behind her. And now I like being behind her. But besides that,
who doesn't?
But yeah, I contacted her right away. I emailed her on MySpace, and she called me in like 15 minutes after that to set this thing up, and her husband were big fans of Dawn of the Dead and Slither, so it made it easy.
So how many episodes are in this first series here?
Well, we've already shot 5 episodes, and we're just going to keep shooting them, so we'll see how many it ends up being.
So,
700, 800 probably episodes of easy porn. We'll see.
I'm all for it.
You know, I'm gonna keep doing them as long as I'm having a good time, and as long as I think they're funny. And once that stops, then I'll quit and do something else. And I am actually doing all this other stuff at the same time, so it's a little hard to balance PG porn with everything else I'm doing.
You are, and let's mention these other two projects here. I'm kind of an Xbox moron. So explain Humanzi to me.
Humanzi, well, here's what it is. Xbox Live has 11 million users on Xbox Live, and what they do is they play games against each other, but something Xbox is also making a lot of money off of now is people are downloading movies and TV shows in high definitions onto their console and watching them. And that, so that the Xbox machine has become an overall entertainment system as opposed to just a gaming console. So Xbox is premiering this new platform in this new software in November, and they came to me because they knew that I'm into this stuff, and they asked me if I could think of any sort of content to create for them. They wanted to create their first ever original content. Basically, Xbox would be like their own network and have their own shows.
Mm-hmm.
And they talked to me, and I had, the day before, I had been talking to, it was honestly like the day before, I talked to Rob Zombie during the day, and I had told him about this comedy project I was doing, and he said, you know, I'd love to do a comedy project, you know, but everybody thinks of me as a horror director, and I would love to do something like that. And I'm like, wow, here's Rob Zombie, who's a much bigger director than I am, and he really wants to be able to do comedy. And people let me kind of do what I want with comedy because I did the Scooby-Doo movies, and Slither was basically a comedy as much as a horror film. But a lot of my friends who are horror movie directors, they see them as strictly horror movie directors. And I'm like, wow, that's interesting. I went to a party that night. It was actually the premiere for Wrong Turn 2, Joe Lynch's movie, and James Wan, the director of Saw, was there. And we were talking about this, and he's like, yeah, I really want to do a romantic comedy. And I'm like, wow, the director of Saw wants to do a romantic comedy. That's a little strange, but why not? He's actually a very soft-spoken, sweet guy. And I'm like, that's interesting. So I got this idea in my head when I was talking to Xbox that it would be great to create a series of shows of horror directors directing comedy shorts. It would give them all a chance to do something that would, you know, be outside of the box, be outside of their comfort zone. I'm completely cheating, of course, because half of what I've done, if not more, has been in the realm of comedy, really, much more. So, mm-hmm. But everybody else was doing something that would be unique for them. And if it worked, you know, if people were funny and did something really good, then that would be great for their careers. And if it was bad, you know, who really cares, you know?
Right.
That was the idea, was to produce these shorts of horror directors doing comedies. And the one that I decided to do is called Humanzy, and it's about a human-chimp hybrid played by my brother Sean, and I'm actually acting in it. He plays my son. I send my sperm to a secret laboratory in Bratislava, and they take the sperm and put it in a turkey baster, shove it up a chimpanzee's vagina, and impregnate her with my sperm, which is physically possible, actually, which a lot of people don't know. And she becomes pregnant with my Humanzy son, and they send him back to me in sort of this crappy low-end FedEx box. And he lives with me and my roommate Val, who was played Marie Martini in Romeo and Juliet, and it's done in the style sort of an old 70s sitcom, except for we're just unspeakably cruel to the Humanzy throughout the show. The whole idea of a Humanzy started. Mm-hmm. I wrote a blog for MySpace again that people reacted really positively to, and it was simply because I was talking to my friend Stevie Blackheart, who had seen this Discovery Channel show about Oliver the Humanzy, who people thought was a human-chimp hybrid for many, many years. It ends mm-hmm. up they did DNA testing on him, and he was just a mutant chimp. But he did a lot of things that were like a human being, and I was fascinated with this idea of a Humanzy. I went out to a party that night with a couple of friends of mine, and we just kept joking about having our own Humanzy sons and how that would be kind of cool. You know, we could dress them in clothes like us and, you know, take them to parties, and girls would want to be around us because we had these, you know, Humanzy sons, and we could make them, you know, smoke clove cigarettes and, you know, the stuff you do to a dog, blow pot smoke in their air, all that sort of stuff. And then when we were bored with them, we could just put them in a kennel in the back of the car, unlike an actual
sure.
child. So a Humanzy would be the perfect thing to have, and I wrote a blog about that, and people were so excited and started making this freakish art of me as a Humanzy that
right.
I decided to make the TV show.
I know you've been so generous with your time. I want to just ask one quick question about the Scream Queens. It premieres on VH1 on the 20th of this month, I believe. This is a reality series, and the prize is an appearance in the next Saw film, Saw 6. Is that
right?
Correct?
You get a lead role in Saw 6, and we take 10 women, very attractive women, who all want to be actresses. Some of them are actresses and have a lot of experience. Some of them have absolutely none at all, and we put them in a house together, and Shawnee Smith and I and John Homa, who's a great acting coach here in L.A., we put them through a series of challenges to sort of weed out the best of the best, such as we put them in a challenge where we cover them with 15,000 cockroaches and have them act in the scene. And I direct them in a scene every week, and we kick somebody off at the end of each show like you're known to do on a reality show. And
right.
And we pick a winner at the end.
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun, too.
Yeah.
The question that they were unable to get through to ask this question, they typed it up here in the chat room, if I can find it. In Slither, Lloyd Kaufman appears in the movie, and he originally had a line in the film.
Yeah.
Why was that cut? Whose decision was that to cut that line?
Mine.
Wow.
There's the answer.
It didn't work. It didn't work in the scene for a number of reasons. Number one, it just didn't work in the scene. Number two, Lloyd's acting is strained at times. And in this particular moment, I wouldn't say he was turning in an exact, you know, it wasn't exactly an Olivier-type performance.
Right.
So I cut it. I get shit about it all the time, too, but I cut it because it was bad. Made the
you got to do what you got to do.
Let's take one more caller. He's been waiting on the line. 720 area code. I think this is Denver. Go ahead. Man, what is wrong with our phone system tonight? 832 area code. Go right ahead.
Hi, my name is Herbert Bennett, and I'm
yes,
a music
sir.
Producer. And I'm a big fan of the Slither movie. And I produce
Thanks.
Music that is reggae and rap, and with a kind of like a fuse of a punk rock type thing. And I was wondering, how would I get my music into Mr. Gunn's films.
Okay.
Huh. That's a good question.
Wow.
You know, it's like usually I work with the music. It just depends on the scene. I mean, I actually, you know, I do use music. I you know, if you put it up, you have a MySpace page? If you have a MySpace page, send me a link to the MySpace page, and sometimes I check it out. Sometimes I don't have time, to be completely frank. But sometimes
okay.
I check out music. One of the bands, the music that we use in Human Z is by a band called Couple out of Malaysia, who are like a Malaysian power pop band, and they sent me their link, and I'm like, God, look at these people from Kuala Lumpur playing music, and their music was amazing. And so I got the rights to use their music in Human Z, and it works perfectly. So I do occasionally just meet somebody. A lot of times I use people I know, too. I have Jane Jensen's songs and Slither and my friend Willie Wisely and people like that.
All righty. You have the answer, caller. Thanks so much for calling in, man. Mr. Gunn, thank you for spending so much time with us this evening, and you're a lot of fun. Come back anytime you'd like.
Thank you, Mr. Gunn.
Thank
Please,
you.
It's
I appreciate
a pleasure.
You,
it was a real pleasure.
Thank you. For me, too. Have a great night.
Me too.
Bye-bye, sir.
Bye.
That is writer, director, author, musician, actor... James Gunn.
He has all the fun, man. All these great shows he's doing.
That's right. Slither, Dawn of the Dead remake, and he has three new projects that we spoke of. Scream Queens, reality TV series on VH1, PG porn on Spike.com. And the other project, the Xbox Live project
definitely.
For Manzi. He's a lot of fun. Our next guest called in previously, and we're in the middle of a conversation. We're about to close up, and he should be calling in again very soon. As soon as he shows up here on our switchboard, I will patch him in. I'm very excited about this film, and I'm particularly talking to this next guest. He's just
extraordinary
talent. And he has very interesting experiences in the music world. And, of course, the new score of his that we're discussing tonight is for Oliver Stone's film W.
W, which has been seen and reviewed.
Yes, the reviews are out there.
They are out there.
So, and we couldn't be more excited about this film because we're all big Oliver Stone maniacs here on the show.
We just want to see this. I mean, this looks like a return to form, but it just...
Yeah.
Let's just see it. You know?
I've been looking forward to it. It feels like forever, but it hasn't been but a few months. All right, our next guest is on the line.
Excellent.
As everyone knows, we're crazy about film composers here on the show, and if you're like us, you are in for a real treat tonight. Paul Cantillon is an exceptionally talented musician who made his violin debut at the age of 13 at UCLA's Royce Hall. He studied in Switzerland, Paris, and at Juilliard, and his resume of breathtaking work includes solo classical piano releases, collaborations with performers as diverse as Yo-Yo Ma and the Red Hot Chili Peppers, several albums with the alternative band Wild Colonials, of which he is a founding member. And on the film front, he's delivered stunning compositions for a number of films, including Everything is Illuminated and The Diving Bell and The Butterfly. His new score serves Oliver Stone's upcoming release, W, and you will be able to hear an exclusive track from W later on in the program, and it is a great work. It is a terrific honor to welcome this extraordinary musician to the show, Mr. Paul Cantillon. Let me bring his line up. Mr. Cantillon, are you with us?
Yes, I'm. That's so kind. I'm so overwhelmed how generous of you.
Well, I'm overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed by your work. It's just gorgeous, and I can't wait to speak to you about it.
Well, an honor for me to speak to you. That's so kind. Goodness.
I was reading that your mother was a musician. Did you take a lot of your love of music from her?
I did. My mom was. I'm so proud of her. She was a very great trumpet player, and one of the first women to be briefly first chair in the Philadelphia Orchestra pre-war days in the 30s, and she had the most beautiful tone and was a great, really a great lyrical player. And though my background was crazy musically in my childhood, but I did take a great deal from her. And she was of Welsh extraction and loved the Welsh hymns and folkloric melodies. And she's still razor sharp and a bit frail, but up pushing 90 at this point.
Yeah.
great musical.
Give me well first. Did you pick up the violin first and then you moved to the piano?
I did. I played violin from the age of 7, and my father was many things, but most dramatically a faith healer, and mm-hmm. led a wild sort of gypsy life. And in his travels, I was in Zurich in Switzerland, and I met this wonderful lady who was like a grandmother to me and taught me the violin, and that was my first instrument, and I changed to piano in my early teens. Mm. And always the gypsy life musically. But
Tell me what music does for you. Can you verbalize it?
I think that's a difficult question to really put into, rather an answer to put into words, but what it does wonderfully is music takes over where words cannot be as expressive. So I used to always say that it's the best reason to be a musician, an artist, or of any pursuit. If that becomes your language, even if it's the back of the Salvation Army, it's worth it. Because you can say things in music, one can hopefully, even if it's just for oneself, that you can't in words. So
yeah.
I've always treasured it for that, for how much of a struggle it can be, but it's worth it so much.
And it seems to be the most direct way to a person's heart as well. I mean, I mean to sound cheesy about it, but
not at all. It's lovely.
It really is a universal language.
It is, and it's if you can. That's always what it. I mean, that was just always my attempt at communication. So if you can reach someone emotionally in a way, or feel you do, even for a moment, it just makes it all worthwhile. So,
yeah.
That's massively worth it.
Let me ask you, if I may, I read something interesting where you had to basically relearn music at a young age. I think you had an accident at 17 and you suffered amnesia. But you still had the passion for music. You just had to reeducate yourself on the discipline.
I did. I really. It's extraordinary in time because it was the late 70s and. Naturally, obviously, it's been a long time, but I had, I couldn't really play anymore at all, and when I reapproached the piano, because the violin was, at this point, that was way in the past, though, in another way, in rock music, I played the violin later, which was fun, but I reapproached the piano and had to get to know people that I had forgotten so much. I had so much damage that everything was a relearning experience. And what it did was, the one wonderful thing is it freed me from the shackles of being a concert pianist, the just playing repertoire and the 8 hours practice a day and all the bits that go with it. And now I was trying to write music. So when I reapproached the piano, I was in a different, utterly different space. And for that, I'm grateful, because it was just to try and write has been sort of the joy of my life, and hopefully will continue to be. So for that, I don't regret. As traumatic as it was worth it for that change.
Well, and I can see this in your work and the versatility of your work. I mean, you play such an eclectic. Eclectic genres of music, and you know all the many different instruments. I would think that would be crucial when it comes to composing a film. Isn't that the case?
That's well said. I mean, hopefully it's a help to have some diversity, and that's been the joy in film, or in my attempts to, one tries to enter into a character, and you never know where it's going to take you. But I love melody. I think there's as much as of my classical past that that's the main. It's so hard in words. It's easier to play. But I do think that really is a help to have some form of diversity. It's kind of you to say.
Yeah.
If I have a little bit.
Let's talk a little bit about the composing process and in terms of the new project, which is For All Over Stone's W.
Yes.
We talked to many composers. We've talked to from Howard Shore to Mark Isham and on and on and on. And we're crazy about film composition. So I wanted your take on the composer as storyteller, which essentially everyone that works on a film crew is an assistant storyteller. When you look at the footage from W, what do you have to understand about the film before you can compose those first notes?
It was such a, it was such an adventure, and really an honor to work with Oliver, who's such a wonderful artist. And it took me to many places in my life, which I really treasure from my past. From I mentioned briefly my father being a faith healer, and a very good-hearted, extraordinary man. But I had a lot of my early years were in. Externally in tent meetings and this sort of old evangelistical tent meeting, like revival meetings of the South, which was, as you can imagine, a pretty wild experience. And I knew those hymns and tunes so well, which sort of would be Louisiana, Texas, Arkansas, all through that area. And a great deal of the film, which you know I can't wait till you see it. It's a wonderful work. Is this period in George Bush's life where he met up with these wild evangelists and had sort of this life-changing experience, which as mad as his life is, and you know I don't even venture to go on, and that's another subject, but this is shown so extraordinarily in this film. So just answered very mercifully for you as briefly as I can. To be allowed to go back to that place and to go into that musical realm again, to tell this story, which is told so extraordinarily and so subtly in the film, I think it's quite wonderfully done. That was wild. It was like the therapy I never had or should have had, just to go back and to venture into that realm again. That's only one aspect. And then otherwise, the wonderful script, this work, which is positively Shakespearean because it's tragic and comic and many, it's an emotionally an absolute roller coaster. And I don't even know where to start. You could ask me specifically bits, but it was... Amazing,
you brought up some aspects of Stone's work that I think bear repeating, because people often take the opposite view without really exploring what he's doing in these films.
Yeah.
You mentioned the subtlety and the Shakespearean quality.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we certainly see that with many of his films, not the least of which is Nixon, which everyone thought would be a controversial kind of hatchet job, but it's anything but. So we have nothing but admiration for Stone here on this show. I know that there was a big time pressure with this project. I think it just got off the ground earlier this year, and it's being released next week.
Yes, exactly.
What does that do for you in your process as an artist? Is that helpful or hurtful?
I found at the time, as intense as it was, I had really the honor of being, which is so unusual for composers too, that I was on set a great deal during the shooting of it in Shreveport, Louisiana. And I would imagine that he, in some way I could say he would be what I would imagine Pasolini or these extraordinary directors, especially of the Italian school were like, where the composers were there, they watched these scenes, they went to their keyboards, I write everything at the piano, and then with the director that sort of crafted in a very collaborative way, and he had this brilliance, which I would liken him to the 19th century character of Svengali, in that wonderful novel Trilby, where this great singer is hypnotized to give these extraordinary performances. And I found he had this way of, with everyone, of getting things out of people, out of artists, people everywhere that they don't really know that they have. So he would coach me very clearly of what he wanted to extract. And often I would think, I wonder how this is going to work, because I would just be on the set watching these extraordinary performances, and then later it would happen that he would extract the melodies and the emotions that he was looking for. So I felt it was very galvanizing. I'll never forget it. It was just such a challenge, but a great challenge, but a great treat to be in this situation.
Yeah. And by all looks of it, I think the time constraints, it adds a certain urgency to the project, too. It's a perfect time to release it. I mean, there's the urgency in that respect. But
enormously.
It's the energy of it. And listening to this track that we're going to premiere a little later in the show, I know oftentimes the movie, they try to sell the movie, and it doesn't necessarily reflect exactly what the movie is, but you see the advertisements, and
sure.
it looks very funny.
It's what's hilariously funny in many bits, wonderfully.
Yeah, this piece of music, though, it's very hauntingly beautiful that we're going to play later, and I'm wondering what those conversations were between you and Stone in terms of texturing the musical voice for this film.
It was so daring and extravagant. It seemed musically such an extravagant, roller coaster of emotions, that there was, in the beginning when I started, very much this sort of simple, almost, as he requested, a stubborn, almost childish, melodic, very, very simple pieces and these waltzes in this sort of Texas style. This was the first color that appeared, and then there was requested in the spirit of Nino Rota this very clown-like, comical, not in a sort of hurtful manner, but this very, very comical, like opera buffa music that was requested in, especially in the period where he was running for governor of Texas, and it was his beginning of his campaigning. And then, most dramatically, which you're mentioning, the last, which was called The Dark Empire, the White House years, and there was, how shall I put this, but I'd love to try to, as requested. There was a hope to find a piece that would be the consequences of war, of the fallout from it, and it has horrendously difficult as that is to show in music. This was a hope to try at least and find this. And
yeah.
So thus the it's truly a wild gamut of emotions from all of those different styles, which you'll just have to tell me what you think when you see the film, because all of these styles are there. It's very, very, very daring. And what you mentioned Nixon and such, which is so fantastic, because I love that one of the first things I ever said to Oliver was the fact that I loved that he was so daring. He used music so wildly daringly and with great courage and shockingly daring, really, when one thinks of it. And when I first met him, one of the first things I brought up was, in Nixon, there's that wonderful John Williams score, and then in the beginning, as best as I recall, there's this extraordinary overture, and then there's the Bible, the old Bible verse from Isaiah used, which is, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul?
Yeah.
And this comes across the screen, and then the music stops in this sudden, like subito, immediate stop, and then there's this wild, comical piece that's played, and it's just so shocking, it's so daring, and I have the gumption to try to say this to him, and he looked at me very quietly for a moment, and then he laughed and said, "Yeah, you're right. It's pretty kooky, and the way that it's used so daringly." So, this was enormous fun. It's so fun when people take such risks.
Yeah, and he definitely. And I've been so impressed with the music in his films as well. From, I think of those extraordinary John Williams scores in Nixon,
yeah.
JFK, and Born on the 4th of July, just
incredible.
The sweeping nature of that music, and he's incredible sensibility with music. We're speaking to composer Paul Cantillon, an amazing musical talent. His new work is for Oliver Stone's upcoming release, W. And just a side note, if you're interested in W, you can go back through our archives last week when we spoke to
Toby Jones, who portrays Karl Rove in the film. Tell me about the different directors that you've worked with. You've worked with a variety of great filmmakers. Do they all come to the table with a musical sensibility? Are they all similar in that respect?
Yes, I must say I've been so fortunate. It's such a wonderful group in my few years that I've enjoyed working, trying to work in film. They've been an amazing bunch and musically gifted and sensitive in their requests and deeply musical. Mm. And with some wonderful examples, the extraordinary Julian Schnabel, who used music like paint so much, which was the only way I can describe. He would use as if he was painting with the notes themselves and had very, very clear idea of, you know, how to use it. So it's been, I've been lucky. I think, you know, I hope I have good fortune with such an amazing coterie of artists, you know.
Yeah. The sound, forgive me if this is a pedestrian kind of question, but I often talk film scores with my friends. We're all movie geeks, so we're all crazy about every aspect of film. And oftentimes they make observations like film composers are the new kind of, it's the new kind of classical music.
Well, right.
Do you put any credence into that comparison?
I think it's because it's just I think it's brought so much music to life, which is would be very hard to find an audience or a way to perform. How shall I answer this? It's my experience has been so interesting. I've worked with a very, very great music supervisor called Sue Jacobs, who I was making a classical album with. And this is some years ago how I began, and she suggested that I read a script and write something for this, which was Everything's Illuminated.
Mm.
And there I found, here was this piece that I started to try and write, which was very, really childlike and simple and melodic piece. And that came to life, and I had the great luck of getting this job and starting to write for it. But it's a long answer, but I think necessary for me to try and say, because I don't really see where I would have played these works outside of the forum of film.
Yeah.
And for that, it's brought me a lot of joy, because it can bring music to life that otherwise you'd be, you know, back of a nice restaurant or somewhere trying to play these bits. So
yeah, and it is in service of the particular film that you're working on. And,
yeah.
And I know that some composers have spoken to others in the field that tailor their music around how well it will sound on a CD, and that's kind of betraying what your job is as a composer, to just service that film.
That's very well said, and what that has to be known first and foremost. I was, you know, lucky to be coached in that consciousness, because it really is, the whole point is to bring the character to life and to service the film. That's the only way. But I think once one knows that, it can be very deeply gratifying and bring so much music that would be, in melodic classical music particularly, it would not have an audience. So that part's been, and also it's great fun to try and express a character and enter into their psyche and make, and to see a director feeling supported by this. It's really, that can be quite thrilling if it works. Painful at times, but thrilling.
Do you have any kind of dream projects? Do you long to compose a Western or a sci-fi epic or any goals like that?
In film music?
Yes, sir.
It's interesting. I've been fortunate in having subjects that are so dramatic, and I love drama, and probably leading more to things that are slightly more tragic. Just, it sounds rather morbid, but, you know, that would be, my music's often, interestingly, I've done comic bits, but it's quite melancholic.
Mm.
But from my heritage, though, my mom is Welsh, but my father is very Irish, and I love Celtic music, like the ancient Celtic music. I'd love to be able to do something that I could really, you know, go to those limits and something that would be deeply Celtic, particularly Irish or Welsh Irish. That I would adore that. But
yeah,
maybe something.
this is, I'm sure it'll happen. This is always a fun question. Do you have favorite film scores?
Oh goodness, yes. From gamuts of let me think. Rebecca, Betty Blue, Back to the Days, all the many, many Italian films that I adore. So, Night of the Shooting Star.
Right. Okay.
At the Funny Group, and certain the great English ones, of course. The beautiful source music, but With Nail and I, Entertaining Mr. Sloan, the great Georgie Fame. I love the darkness and these are some of them very comic, but wonderful scores that are often overlooked, but they're so wonderful.
Yeah. Earlier I asked you what music did for you. What do you hope that you've done for music?
I would hope that, just said so, you know, it sounds a bit childish, but I would really be happy if it can, there's emotional honesty, it can touch people in some way, and it can make, music can so help to show the vulnerability of a character, especially someone as torturous as George Bush, where this is a great example, where it's so exquisitely directed, it shows the complexities of a person, which are just, you know, beyond description. So if music can help in some small way to do that, then it's very gratifying. I would love to have, you know, been in the direction of trying to do that, hopefully.
Yeah, well, by all accounts, you've done it magnificently. The film is W. Your soundtrack, your score for that is currently available. I know it's available on iTunes. I take it it's available in stores as well now.
On the, I believe the 17th, it's in stores.
The 17th. Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have any projects upcoming in the film or
just
otherwise?
Some that are sort of ruminating about. I keep writing all the time. I've been writing a collection of piano pieces that I hope to record. In good faith, I'll start something new. I'll tell you gleefully when I know, but I'm just had a bit of a break, which is pleasant after this. And then it's fun. The premiere is coming up next week and various screenings, so that'll be fun.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Cantillon, we're crazy about your work on the show, and I cannot wait to play this piece of your score from the film towards the end of the show. It's going to be a real treat. It's beautiful, and we appreciate your time very much tonight.
Well, yes, we do.
Thank you. Thank you both. It's an honor to be part of it, and you're very encouraging. And
you're welcome back on any time you'd like.
Thank you. I look forward. I love it. And thanks for bearing. My father is such a great public speaker. I've always been terrible, but thanks for bearing with my whole
family. You've been wonderful.
You've been wonderful.
Thank
you. Yeah, you're wonderful, my friend.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Till soon. Bye.
That is Paul Cantillon, a great musician, a great guest. I love talking about film music, man.
We all do.
I get so geeky.
It's natural. And what you said is, you know, about film music is like the best way for classical music to survive. Because actually a friend of our show and a friend of mine I used to work with, Elliot Roberts, said he majored in music in college. And his professor said film music is the best way to hear classical music in this day and age. The widest audience, that's how it's going to survive, through film soundtracks.
Yeah. And there are those, it helps when you're working with a great film, too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure. But there are some pieces of music, even separated from the film, that the themes just don't leave you.
Mm-hmm. I can't wait to hear it.
Yeah, it's a beautiful, haunting, kind of subdued piece of music, and it makes me even more interested in the film, because this isn't the voice of the film that we've been sold so far. You could almost tell that Stone is kind of defying the naysayers just by listening to this extraordinary piece of music.
Right.
Yeah. Let me tell you about another extraordinary film, and then we'll play this interview with the director of this picture. By the way, you guys will hear that that composition. It runs just over 6 minutes at the closing of our show tonight. Let the Right One In is the horror film that is currently getting a lot of buzz, and for good reason. It's a Swedish, I guess you could call it a genre film involving vampires, but that's so limiting to what the
right,
picture
right.
actually is. It almost, there are some filmmakers, and I put David Lynch in this category, there's some filmmakers, when they work, you can imagine that they've never seen a film before.
Right.
That's not a negative, because they create works that are unlike anything you've ever seen before. They're so free of the conventions that you're used to in the genres that they're working in. This Let the Right One In is the story of a young boy who is perpetually abused by bullies. He doesn't lead a very happy life, a broken home. He reluctantly befriends a new neighbor, a girl who's very shy and introverted, and they form a very close pact. They need each other to survive what they're going through. She just so happens to be a vampire. The film the pacing is, you just feel every frame of this film. It's beautifully shot. Another film that has a gorgeous score. And so much is, as I point out in the interview, so much is expressed in the silences in this film. It's a very patient film.
Mm-hmm.
And the horror elements, they don't jump out at you and say boo, you know, they just kind of seep in, and they're so gracefully handled. More than anything else, I walked away from this film feeling a tremendous amount of empathy for these two lead characters. And that is not often something that you feel in a horror film. It almost reminded me of the film Carrie, even though they're very different.
Mm-hmm. But okay, all right.
I've always loved Carrie because the movie spends the first hour and a half really rallying for your sympathy for this girl, and you're with her, and you feel her, you feel for her, and all hell breaks loose in the last 15 minutes of Carrie, and it's even more effective for that reason. Now, De Palma is, Let the Right One In is no less visual, but De Palma is, by all accounts, and we love him here, a flashier kind of filmmaker. He's operatic. This is like a chamber piece, this film.
Okay.
It's gorgeous. I mean, it really is. It opens up in New York and L.A. on the 24th. And we had a listener look us up on our MySpace page. And I will say your name later on because I do appreciate your interest in the show. He got to me too late. He wanted me to ask a couple of questions of the director of this film, Mr. Thomas Alfredson. And unfortunately, this interview was pre-recorded this morning. He was making the rounds at a New York press junket. So I didn't get your questions in time. But I did briefly ask one of them, and we're talking about Jason Warner here. Thank you so much for being a fan of the show and for your interest in the show. So I don't think you'll be disappointed by the interview. So let's go ahead. Enough talking about this. Let's play our exclusive interview with the director of Let the Right One In, Mr. Thomas Alfredson. Tell me a little bit about this. Seems to be new territory for you. This is the first time you've tackled this kind of so-called horror genre, although that seems like a limited classification for this film. But was that whole question of can I pull this off one of the attractions for you?
I really didn't understand the last part there.
Was it the challenge of seeing if you could pull off this type of film? Was that one
of
the attractions
well,
for you?
Well, it's quite new for me, but then at the same time it's not, because I think of my trade as I'm a storyteller. So it could be a funny story or a sad story or a horrifying story or a dull story, whatever. So that's really nothing new to me. And I have also been doing quite a lot of television and feature films with children. So that's not so new to me either. So,
yeah.
And I used to pick projects, you know, the ones I like, and I really it really doesn't matter what kind of genre or what kind of in what shelf they will turn up in the video store later on. So it really doesn't matter to me.
Yeah, I can tell that it's the variety that really excites you, because if I read correctly, you went from this film to directing a stage production of My Fair Lady, is that correct?
Yeah.
Wow. That's fantastic. So tell me, when it comes to Let the Right One In, what new kinds of directorial muscles were you able to exercise by doing this film?
Well, the biggest effort was to or the biggest challenge was to get into the world of CGI, I think. And that's very interesting, and it's a sort of also a confusing world because you could do practically anything with CGI. So it says if you were put in front of a white paper with 3,000 pencils in different colors, or if you were to be sit with just one, and it would be probably more easy to sit with the just one chalk, you know, to get started. If you have 3,000 pencils, you get somehow stiff, or you don't know really where to begin. And that's the same thing with CGI. You could do almost anything. Then it's very, very important that you have a very strong idea and very strong vision before you start working with it, because it could really get you into a maze.
I agree with you, and the use of CGI seems particularly disciplined here, because you don't notice it. And when you're dealing with that, all those colors that you just mentioned, it's easy to go too far or get too extravagant with it, but
yeah.
To the film's credit that it's always rooted in the reality of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about the book. This is based upon, adapted from a book. What drew you to that book? What were the themes or the qualities that attracted you?
Well, I think it was, this was 3 years ago when I read it for the first time, and I thought that it was, for being a story about a bullied child, this was so unsentimentally told. And I had some periods during my childhood when I was bullied too. So I would think that was the strongest part that shook me the most.
Yeah. Me too.
Mm-hmm.
I was in that boat as well as a kid. So
mm-hmm.
I didn't have a vampire for a best friend. I wasn't that fortunate, but
neither did I.
But now that you've touched upon having experience directing children and also these two lead characters, there are many reasons why the film is so emotional for me. But I'd like to touch upon two in particular, and one of the reasons are the young actors that you use to portray your two leads. I think one critic said that they had an otherworldly quality, and I think that's telling it like it is. How extensive was the search for these two kids, and what were you looking for from them?
Well, I regard those two characters as the same one, two sides of the same character, really. But they should, in every sense, they should mirror each other, but some sort of attract each other at the same time. So they were supposed to be the two sides of the same coin. So that was a complicated process, and it took nearly a year to find them in a very extensive casting process throughout Sweden. And we don't have professional children's actors in Sweden, so you have to rely on open castings. But then I was looking for children who was especially the Ellie character, an old child, sort of. And I think that Lina, who plays Eli, she is like 75 years old behind those eyes, in a very special way. And that is a very, she's a very calm and very quiet and very secretive little child. And I think she's, both her and Kåre, who plays Oscar, they made a fantastic job. They really did.
Yeah, they really, and I think a big thing that impressed me about their performances is so much is expressed in what they don't say, in the silences, and that's a true actor there. Tell me about directing younger people. Do you handle them the same way as you would an adult, particularly when this film delves into some kind of horrific elements? Tell me about that.
Well, yes and no. It's the same kind of work as you do with grown-up actors. And then at the on the other hand, it's not. Because if you talk to a grown-up actor, he or she would have to, you know, take responsibility for a lot of scenes in one scene, if you see what I mean. You could say this is a part of a long sequence, and this is this piece of the puzzle we are doing right now in the end before you're cracking up or whatever in the drama. But you really couldn't say that to a child. You couldn't say that to a child that you are in the middle of a crisis and this is 5 minutes before you crack up. You have to be very, very specific in each and every shot and just talk about that very shot and emphasize on that. So that's the big difference with children. And then you have to have some sort of atmosphere of playing, to play with the children and have to a playful atmosphere, and also you could come into situations 2 o'clock in the morning when everybody's very stressed, and suddenly the child says, "I want to go home now," or I'm freezing, or this is boring, or whatever. And then you have to have that relation with the kid, so that you could say without being rude, you could say, "This is very important. We have to do this right now. Come on, let's do it. It's over in 10 minutes," and so on. So that's it's a very strange professional situation, having 50 people standing in the middle of the night that is depending on a 10-year-old. Who's maybe very tired or very grumpy or something.
Yeah. Well, by all evidence, you're fantastic at that approach. I don't know if you follow the horror genre much, but this film is so fresh. And part of the reason why it works so well is because you empathize so much with these characters. Now, were there typical horror conventions that you kind of set out to avoid, or was that already inherent in the book?
You know, everything is that has to do with horror myths or horror history has to do with Mr. Lindquist, the author's knowledge of this, because I'm really uneducated in those matters, and I haven't seen any horror films or studied them specifically for this one either. So I have studied other kinds of materials to get into this genre.
Yeah. And the music, too. I wanted to bring up the music. Your score for the film is deeply emotional as well. It gives the film such a sense of gravity and loss. How involved were you in that composing process?
Well, a lot. The composer, Johan Söderqvist, he's a fantastic composer. he and I, we were discussing what kind of we wanted to add a lot of brightness to it, a lot of brightness to it, because it's such a dark story. So I would think we wanted to go with a romantic the romantic touch on it as much as possible, and then not using the score as an effect or a commentary. That's some sort of thing you have heard thousands of times, those very typical horror effects on the music track.
Yeah, and the approach to the film is so honest, which you're used to being manipulated so much in this type of genre film. It's really refreshing. And I know that audiences around the world have found the same kind of refreshing quality to it. What's this experience been like traveling around the world with the film, and have the reactions differed at all, say, from the U.S.?
Yeah, in some senses. I have to stop now. Everybody's waving at me. But so this would be the last question then.
Okay.
Is it all right?
Oh, that's fine. That's fine.
Okay. So we had some very nice reactions throughout the world, and people sound different. In Scandinavia, in the cinema, it's totally quiet. It's dead quiet. So, and if you come here to the United States, everybody's sounding a lot, and that's something really unusual for a filmmaker to come to the cinema, and everybody's sighing and laughing or cheering or whatever, and that's so nice to listen to hear what the people, what the audience think.
Yeah. The film opens in New York and LA on October 24th. You
and
can
in
just say
Stockholm.
Yes. I'm sorry.
And in Stockholm too.
Yes.
October 24th. Yeah.
Yes. And you could just say yes or no to this, because my listeners will kill me if I don't ask it. Are you involved at all with this planned remake?
No, not at all.
Okay, good for you. I appreciate your time very much. It is a beautiful film, and
thank you very much. It was very nice talking to you.
You too, sir. Bye-bye now.
Okay, take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, that's director Thomas Alfredson. The movie is Let the Right One In. Go check it out, New York and L.A., October 24th, and I'm sure it'll platform out from there.
Sounds good. It's a great interview.
It's a wonderful movie. And I did get that question about the remake in there, so...
Yeah.
I was like, oh, God, don't wave it down yet. I got to ask the question.
I know, yeah.
I don't know how I feel about that. This is such a perfect movie on its own, but, you know. Maybe it'll get more people to watch this film. Who knows?
I don't see any reason why not. So
it hasn't even released yet.
I hate when they do that though. They buy the rights. Yeah, I mean, it's horrible.
Yes. Yes. Well, but that lets you know how great the film is, and you know
yes.
The film is. They know they've got a hot ticket there. Okay, I'm going to enlist the help of the chat room now. I need you guys to tell me something. You know, we have over a quarter million listeners, but we're very low tech here on the show. So, in episodes past, I have I've muted your line, Jerry, but not muted my line when we've played selections and interviews and such, because I've been afraid that if I mute the master line, it'll mute the actual file.
Right.
I'm not sure I'm not sure about the answer to that. So I'm going to play a little bit of our theme for the show after I mute my line. People in the chat room, tell me if you can still hear it. And for those of you listening to this on archive, I apologize. Just you can tune out for this brief 30-second period here. Here we go. Jerry, I've unmuted yours. Chat room, were you able to hear that piece of music? Please answer as soon as humanly possible. Well, he could hear it. Okay.
And the futurists could hear it too. Okay.
We have great success.
Okay.
How embarrassing is that? I just want to make sure that we bring out this piece of music as it so deserves. It's such a beautiful piece of music. Jerry, are you excited about any, because we're going to close the show with this piece of score, are you excited about any upcoming films this weekend?
Body of Lies is really principally the main thing I'm looking forward to. And I
keep confusing that with Body of Evidence.
I know.
That Bad Madonna movie.
Well, that would be a very interesting if you could match those two up.
Where's the candle wax scene between DiCaprio and Russell Crowe? I just
Greg, you gotta make sure I get thrown out of this one. No, I'm looking forward to that, and I still want to see. Well, I think it goes in the wider release this weekend, The Duchess with Keira Knightley, and I guess next weekend it's all about W and to a lesser extent maybe Max Payne, but. The next couple of weeks should be interesting. October always brings out, but I mean, W is for me the big movie of the month.
Yeah.
I mean, and also the Kevin Smith movie at the end on Halloween of all days.
Yeah. That should be a good scary one.
Yeah.
speaking of scary, we've really covered horror in this show. We've talked to James Gunn, who's a master of horror comedy. And we talked to Let the Right One In director, and we've discussed a new movie about George Bush. I mean, what?
Well, yeah, I know. You really got
who's a scarier figure than George? Bush? Thank you. We'll be here all night.
We'll be here all night, all week.
Yeah. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. Thank you for your questions in the chat room. Thank you for calling in. We're sorry if we couldn't get to everyone tonight. Limited by time. We thank our guests so much. They're so generous to us tonight and just a wonderful group of talents, and we're constantly in awe of what we're able to provide you with here. Not awe of ourselves, but maybe that came out wrong, but in awe of the talent that is so generous to us here on the show. We're going to close out with this exclusive track from the upcoming film W. It's a track, the title of it is War, by composer Paul Cantillon, and we appreciate you listening very much. You have a good evening. We'll see you back here Sunday night, where we have a great lineup of guests that I can't recall off the top of my head right now.
Okay.
but we will post announcements. Thank you so much, everyone.
All right, good night, everyone.